Welcome to Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia. A few weeks ago, Physicians First Watch covered an article from the Canadian Medical Association Journal on advanced care planning. We gave our coverage the headline, Death, How and When to Start a Conversation About It. The article was very popular with our readers, and I thought it would be good to catch up with the study's first author, Dr. John Yu. Dr. Yu is an associate professor at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Welcome, Dr. Yu.
Thanks, Joe, for having me on.
The principal message seems to be that these conversations aren't easy, but they're essential.
I would absolutely agree.
Your paper mentions that hospital-based clinicians rarely talk with patients about advanced care directives. Why do you think that's true?
I think there are lots of reasons. Certainly when we go directly to hospitalized patients and their family members, we have concrete data that will say that these conversations are not happening often. From my own experience, I think there's a number of reasons. I think one really important reason is kind of just the culture of modern medical system that we've evolved, and in particular the acute care hospital, which is certainly where I work and I'm most familiar with, where the default pathway when patients come into hospital gets activated, and kind of the glide path for patients is to have the treatments automatically provided because they're available and in many circumstances they're effective. But I think we often don't just pause to think about, just because we can do this, should we do this? And I think it's that culture of very treatment-oriented and cure-oriented care, which is, you know, a lot of times that's a great thing, but it's not always the right thing. There are others, but I think fundamentally that's a cultural reason that's very strong.
And having decided that you would like to set someone's advanced care directives, you mentioned three phases of this in your paper, which I have to say is very practical in its orientation, and I'm sure the listeners will find it very useful to get their hands on a copy of it. The first phase is identifying patients at high risk, and you offer some prognosis estimators, and I'll put a link to those estimators on the website. But there's a curbside estimator that you call the surprise question. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure, and so certainly this is not a trigger question that I've developed or we've developed. It was introduced some time ago by folks in the United States. But it's essentially just to ask yourself when you're seeing a patient or caring for a patient, would I be surprised if this patient died in the next 6 months or 12 months? And if the answer is no, I wouldn't be surprised, then I like that trigger question because it really does then give you permission to say, okay, well, it would be important and relevant and beneficial to engage that patient and their family in conversations.
The next phase is the discussion about that discussion with about prognosis with a patient and his or her family. What advice have you got on that score?
So in terms of just practical issues around discussing prognosis, I think first of all, even though we do provide some estimators, as you call them, or tools to make an estimate of life expectancy or risk of mortality, I think the first thing to recognize going in is that it's an imperfect estimate, and there's always going to be uncertainty around those estimates. And I think, you know, it's important to relay that uncertainty to patients and families and also not to get too hung up on the number itself. Mm-hmm. And even giving a range, I think, is probably more helpful in terms of months or weeks or whatever the case may be, but really to focus more on what the patient's needs are or the family's needs are around prognosis in terms of other more concrete, practical, and really important issues around what and you know, what kind of quality of life do they want or should they expect, what kind of events might they expect as their disease unfolds, understanding from them how is that going to impact their role within their family or within their social network. How can we help support them as things change? I think there's a lot of other aspects to prognosis which we might not have delved into fully in the space of a fairly short conversation guide, but that I think there are also important issues to think about when talking about prognosis.
There is the question of reaching a decision, and one of the things that you emphasize in the guide is that this is not a single conversation.
Yeah, I would agree that oftentimes it's certainly more of a process than a single event. Mm. And I don't think we understand fully from patients or families yet, and our research group continues to be engaged in this work, I don't think we understand fully what the preferences of patients and families are around how to kind of phase in the information or, what kind of process would be optimal for them in a hospital setting. But certainly it's been my observation that there's a fair bit of difference amongst patients and family members. You know, we do suggest in our conversation guide to just simply ask patients or families if they do have anything in writing in terms of a living will or an advance directive, or if they understand what we mean when we say those things. And oftentimes people will say, oh yeah, my wife and I have talked about that, and this is the way we feel about it, and we can produce those documents. And in those kinds of situations, it's actually a fairly straightforward conversation about, making sure that the whatever expressed wishes on those documents are still relevant for the current context or their current illness in the hospital, making any revisions if they're necessary. But for other people who've never considered or thought about their wishes for care near the end of life, then I do find that often it may take place over not a single conversation, but over several conversations in the hospital.
Yeah.
And usually you have the time. Not always, but usually you do.
Yeah. And one piece of advice that you give is to, having established those decisions, that they should be recorded clearly in the record. Otherwise it all seems, because as you know, you may not be around when those decisions have to be acted upon.
Right. And the patient, him or herself, often will not have the capacity to confirm, what their prior expressed wishes were because they're critically ill.
It's all very practical, and one of the most practical things that I noticed, it was in a list in a box, was when you have a conversation with your patient, you had two suggestions. The first was to sit down, and the second was to make eye contact.
Yeah, I think these are best practices that come from people who've done a lot of work in communication skills training, also in maybe the related area of breaking bad news. They do seem pretty basic, but it is amazing for those of your listeners who work in a hospital-based setting, as I do, how often we just kind of give body language that might suggest that we don't have a lot of time to talk. And certainly I find in my own experience that just sitting down certainly gives the signal, the nonverbal signal to the patients and families that you do have a lot of time for them. And it may not even be that you spend that much more time in a conversation, but a lot of communication is nonverbal, and those simple things get me a lot.
Your colleagues, how have they responded to your article, and have you heard from readers?
It's been quite phenomenal. I wasn't frankly expecting this kind of response, but I've had lots of people writing from all kinds of corners of the earth, Australia, Israel, France, asking if they can somehow get their hands on a copy of the guide. And in fact, I got to my office after being away for a long weekend and had a voicemail from a patient who had heard a broadcast out in Victoria, British Columbia. So that was quite something.
Now, if you could ask a clinician to start doing something differently today than they may have been doing yesterday as a result of having read your guide, what would the one thing be?
I think it would be like the title of our guide suggests, which is to just ask. And perhaps what we should have also said in there is just ask and then listen, which was actually the message from the patient who left the voicemail with me earlier today. And I think just doing those things, I think a lot of patients and families who are seriously ill, they have in fact thought about these issues because they can see that there are changes in their lives and in their health. But expecting patients and families to start the conversation themselves is, I think, a bit unrealistic and unfair. And if we simply ask and create some space for that conversation to unfold, I think that's probably the most important message out of all of this.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Yu, for spending time with me today on this.
I'm very appreciative for your interest, and thank you very much for your time.
And that was our 164th edition. All earlier conversations may be found at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from Journal Watch. I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.